Hello and welcome to the May Intel Hub event. My name is Nicole Drumhiller and I am the Associate Dean for the School of Security and Global Studies, and I'll be serving as your MC this morning. Today we have Efren Torres-Bakish speaking to us about private sector intelligence. Efren is a senior intelligence analyst with experience in security and investigations. He currently works in the private sector where he focuses on monitoring and investigating entities to prevent violations of the U.S. Office of Foreign Assets Control, impose sanctions, and to detect potential instances of money laundering or illicit financing. He is also the manager of open source intelligence and intelligence analysis training courses offered in collaboration with RIAS. Prior to his current roles, he worked as a regional intelligence analyst focusing on drug trafficking organizations and anarchist groups in Latin America. Today, he's looking forward to answering your questions at the end of the presentation. Again, this meeting is being recorded, and I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Efren, and we'll go ahead and get started.
Very much, Nicole, and I'm very happy to be here. Such quite a big crowd, so hopefully I can give you something that will expand your knowledge, something that you can use. And if you have any questions, please ask at the end of the presentation. And if you want to engage in a further discussion, then obviously you can look me up and we can do a one-on-one on any questions you may have from this presentation. Now, when I talk to people about traditional intelligence in the private sector, I usually get the question of whether I practice business intelligence, competitive intelligence, market intelligence, and even a few people if I do artificial intelligence. I guess this is the general view of when a person says mentions intelligence and private sector, but it is not actually accurate. So there has been this development within this past decade, where traditional open source intelligence units dealing with threats such as drug trafficking or terrorist activities, pretty much, you know, traditional intelligence have been developed within corporations. So that's what I mean by private sector intelligence unit, right? And this is not a new phenomenon per se. Actually, it developed back in the 70s and 80s in the oil and gas industry, where they realized they were operating in medium and high risk locations. And then they need to develop this capability in order also to rely less from the government, right? Now, right here, you see two pictures. The one in the bottom right-hand corner is Mickey Mouse Heart Spies. This is a very old media article from 2007. It is actually one article that the Walt Disney Company doesn't really like because it gives you the wrong impression of what we actually do in the private sector. But it, and then up top you see Global Security Regional Protective Analyst for Hire at Facebook. That's not from so long ago. So this goes off to show about the need for this type of capabilities within the private sector in big companies, such as Facebook and the Walt Disney Company. You have other companies like Google, Tesla, Starbucks, McDonald's, and so on, starting to develop these different intelligence capabilities. Now, in terms of what we do, the scope of the operation, I mean, it is a 24/7 operation designed to monitor people that are threatening the staff, executives, the talent, facilities, or just targeting the company for its reputation. A big leg of what we do is travel risk, travel security. So we dive into open sources to get information on future events, such as protests that may turn violent in certain countries. Let's say, for example, in Chile, Mexico, or Brazil, where some of the protests are known to be violent and protesters are known to engage with the military police or the police in general. Who also deal with trade secrets and insider threats. So you can think of this as counterintelligence applied to the private sector. For compliance investigations, private sector intelligence units are also used in order to dive deep into third parties wanting to partner with a company. And these searches are usually done for anti-money laundering checks, antitrust checks, maybe terrorist financing, reputational checks, and so on. So the big scope is we rely solely on open source intelligence, and I will go a little bit deeper into that in a bit. Now, in order to clear up a little bit of the misconceptions out there, what we do, again, we focus on protecting personnel, facilities, the company reputation from threats and risks throughout the world. We conduct investigations. So this could be either death threats or sexual harassment. I've been engaged in some high-level investigations, and I have examples in upcoming slides. Also, executive protection. One of the big responsibilities is protecting the leadership. So if the CEO, the CFO, or anybody from the C-suite is traveling to anywhere, really, it doesn't have to be a medium or high-risk location, the intelligence unit will keep an eye on the travel. Before it starts, during, and they will report the findings accordingly. They will escalate that to the director of intelligence, up to the various stakeholders in preparation for the trip. Now, what we don't do is we don't aim at replacing or competing with the current intelligence community. We are pretty fluent in open source intelligence collection and analysis, but our job is rather to collaborate in some instances with the intelligence community and law enforcement, but we don't aim at replacing it. We don't spy on other companies, so we don't do industrial espionage. We don't provide companies with information that will give them an advantage or generate revenue. That's more the market, competitive, and business intelligence aspect, which we don't really do. We focus on threats. We focus on anything that may impact the physical aspect of a company, its people, and maybe the brand, the reputation of the company. Now, in terms of the human flow, the human capital that from the intelligence community in the private sector, this you see at the top government intelligence, right? And to me, that's still that's the primary source of intelligence. I mean, they practice it, they've been doing it for a long time, so they're still way at the top of the food chain. Now, when people tend to retire from the government agencies, they either, you know, sometimes they switch to become a defense contractor, so quote-unquote, they never really retire. A few of them, they tend to go to business and competitive intelligence. And in the past decade, a lot of them have transitioned to the private sector intelligence unit and other third-party intelligence providers. Oftentimes, you see director roles and above, vice president and chief security officers in private sector intelligence units, being from the intelligence community / law enforcement. They usually have at least 10 years of experience. And my former boss at the media company where I used to work had 14 years of experience with the CIA, my management team even before that at the other company where I used to work. They used to be from the military. So you have this leadership up there that would take care of pretty much designing the operations in order for them to run pretty much like a mirror image of what an open source intelligence unit is run in the government. But the human capital doesn't necessarily flow this way. I had a lot of co-workers who have switched from the private sector and they have moved into defense contractors such as Booz Allen Hamilton. Some of them, very few of them actually, have moved into business and competitive intelligence, and actually some of them have moved up into the government. So the government is actually very keen in recruiting people from the private sector, especially now if you have experience doing intelligence, collecting open source intelligence, it makes you a very good candidate for intelligence community. Now, what you see here are the three main pillars, the core responsibilities for the private sector intelligence units. So PSIUs are designed to protect the people, to protect the security of the infrastructure, and obviously the reputation / brand of the company. We have to protect it at all costs. I mean, without the people, you really can't have any business. Without an infrastructure, you cannot run the business, and with a bad reputation or a bad brand, you're really out of the business. So these are three core responsibilities that we're meant to protect. And this is something that we have to keep in mind. And one of my old senior intelligence analysts, when I asked him, so why in this order, and I will never forget, he said, people are first and foremost the most important asset in a company. Without people, people are irreplaceable. These are lives. The second is the infrastructure, because you know, if you have the infrastructure, you really can operate a business. You can do it remotely, but you know, you need to have headquarters and so on. And the protection, the brand protection, is it's the, one of the most important things as well. So in that order is usually how I've seen more than one intelligence unit being run in this set of priorities: people, infrastructure, and brand protection. Now, right here, it's more or less it's a mind map of the core responsibilities, like the ramifications of private sector intelligence units. So, if we see the upper left hand corner, tactical intelligence. So that that in an intelligence unit will deal with a lot of travel security. So staff and asset tracking. Again, this will also be executive protection. You also have crisis management, and this we do that in the case of a major event such as a terrorist attack, where everybody needs to collect information immediately within 10 minutes, let's say, and escalate to the director of intelligence or whoever is in charge, and also account for the safety of the travelers. If you have business partners, travelers, company travelers, or executives traveling overseas, you're responsible to reach out to them, make sure that they're okay, report back your findings, and then keep updating the report accordingly to upper management. Then in the middle, you see investigations. This can be either internal or external. Internal, these are for instances of maybe sexual harassment or regular harassment. And then external is when things get very, very serious, usually liaise with law enforcement. And I've had experiences, a few experiences where I've had to liaise with the NYPD for a very serious death threats being sent to somebody within the company. And then in the right hand, you see physical security. And this is just basically doing crime assessments around the vicinity of a facility for the business to allocate extra resources, whether it being guards or cameras, et cetera. Now, we also, to some extent, in my experience, have supported cybersecurity operations, but for some reason, that bridge seems to be a little bit broken in terms of the channel of communication. But I've had the pleasure to exchange intelligence with cybersecurity. It was a back and forth conversation, but it doesn't happen often, but it's there, depending on the intelligence unit and the company, really. And again, you know, you have brand protection, you know, deal with insider threat, industry scandals, anti-company activism. And this is a big one. And depending on the industry, could be pharmaceutical, the media industry, or what have you, you will have different single issue activists. In the pharmaceutical, you'll be looking at animal rights activists trying to infiltrate your company. And that has happened in the past, where animal rights activists have infiltrated laboratories, taking pictures, and so on. Media companies in this era, where you have a very divided opinion, you know, quote unquote right wing and left wing media outlets. Some people may protest your company, call it fake news or anything like that. So companies take single issue activism very, very serious. And then way at the bottom, you have strategic intelligence. And I put it way at the bottom, just simply because not every single intelligence unit has developed this capability. It takes a long time for intelligence units to get to the strategic intelligence level, just because you have a lot of things in the middle. You have to develop standard operating procedures. You need to get the tactical intelligence correctly. You need to make sure that everybody is comfortable doing open source investigations. Everybody is well aware of basically the company structure. Some of these companies are rather big, and they have different satellite companies operating under them. But once they get to that level, then they can do intelligence for a business expansion, such as, you know, new market entry, crime trend analysis, country risk reporting, I recall during my first job in intelligence in the pharmaceutical industry, I had the opportunity to do a country risk assessment. It was an 18-month strategic intelligence slash political assessment on Mexico and Brazil. What happened? You know, you had to take into consideration the political environment. Obviously, a big focus was security. For example, Mexico was the development of the cartel activity throughout the country, etc., and also black pharmaceuticals in the black market, counterfeit, and so on. So again, a lot of the private sector intelligence units are rather new, so they actually tend to struggle a little bit during the first few years on getting tactical intelligence and investigations right before they can even develop the capability to start drafting strategic intelligence assessments for the company. Now, how do we accomplish all of this? Really, as I mentioned before, just solely using open source intelligence. We use databases. When I was training my analyst at my previous intelligence unit, I urged them to use foreign media. That is very important. That's a very important source, especially when you have a global mission. We also tend to use official government documents, such as the OSAC, the Overseas Security Advisory Council, that issues very good country reports, very detailed, especially very tailored to travel security. We use social media intelligence for social media listening, which is, you know, for investigations, and also to collect information on future events, as I mentioned before in the travel security part. We, however, also use third-party intelligence providers. And this could be, you know, there are well-known companies like Control Risks, IHS, Jane, or Dataminer. These are very well-established third-party intelligence providers, and they provide a wide range of services from the travel security that Control Risk may offer to the strategic that IHS offers to real-time monitoring through crowdsourcing coming from Twitter's being offered by Dataminer. And also, a few of the analysts, like me in particular, we use human intelligence sources, and that comes from personal connections, from our coworkers, and or your own previous professional network. And this is very important. Not everybody can do it. So we'll see in upcoming slides what makes a successful intelligence analyst. And one of them is being able to have traveled the world prior to fulfilling your role as an intelligence analyst. It just expands your network. It gives you a certain advantage over those analysts who really have not traveled outside of the United States. Okay, there you go. The profile of a successful intelligence analyst in the private sector. You know, a lot of them usually come from a background from intelligence studies, international relations, political science, but I have seen a lot of them that have come straight from the military, the intelligence community, law enforcement. In certain intelligence units, have seen that they have security guards doing certain intelligence-related tasks with no prior intelligence background. So it really depends on the company you're dealing with. But aside from, I guess, the college part, a person is to have critical thinking skills. Being able to put together the different parts of the puzzle when you're doing a complex investigation or when you're drafting an 18-month security assessment on Mexico requires a lot of critical thinking skills. You need to think outside of the box. And hand in hand with that comes, again, a foreign language and cultural awareness. I cannot emphasize enough how much a foreign language gives you an advantage when you become an intelligence analyst. If you're fluent and you have the cultural context, it really gives you an advantage that other people wouldn't necessarily have, not to say that other intelligence analysts who don't speak a second language cannot be also great analysts. They can. However, If you put them together, the person that has a foreign language and cultural context, we will have a certain advantage that you really cannot find from a media article or from an academic article or from some other type of source. So that gives you really a very big advantage. You know, for that you need to travel the world. You need to develop connections and networks. You need to become an expert on a certain region. A lot of these companies, they really like regional experts. So I am a regional expert in Latin America, but I also had to cover the whole world. So I had to become a generalist in Asia Pacific and EMEA. But my strength was always Latin America. And they liked that, and they capitalized on that during the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. So that it's something that they really, really liked. It's very sought after in the private sector. And really the foundations is the experience dealing with stressful situations. And you need to have very quick reaction times, right? I remember dealing with a few terrorist attacks where I've been by myself in shifts. Nobody else to help me, and I will have 10 minutes from the time I receive the first alert to do open source research, to write up the report, to account for the safety of the travelers, if we had any travelers or executives in the area, and to escalate to the director of intelligence. Now, can you imagine doing this in 10 minutes or even under? Sometimes you have less than 10 minutes if it's something very, very big, like a big terrorist attack. So you need to keep a very, very calm behavior during this. You need to deal well with stress. Not everything is stressful, but when a bomb goes off somewhere, you're going to be put in the hot seat. So it is extremely important that you know how to deal with these different and volatile situations. Now, I want to ask, I'm moving a little bit from the overview of what private sector intelligence units do into more or less the type of training, the type of knowledge that analysts usually possess, to give you a little bit of an overview. So I want to ask, and please feel free to write in the chat if anybody knows who owns the internet. Maybe about 20 seconds. Okay. Okay, yes. Yes, the last response is correct. Well, sort of. It is actually owned by many, but certain aspects are regulated by two U.S. entities, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN, and the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, IANA. They're both equivalent to like the CEOs or the presidents of the internet. ICANN is a policymaker and IANA is an executor. So this is something that I tell my analysts to keep in mind. Just because if you're going to be using open source, you're going to be using the internet to conduct your searches, it is also very important for you to know who owns it, right? Or you know who regulates it. It's also a very nice piece of trivia. Now. And I'm asking this to everybody, if you could tell me what your preferred search engine is. Okay. Okay. If you say Google is a very user-friendly search engine. It has even become a verb. So you can Google this, you can Google that. However, it is highly unreliable. It is unstable. Also, Google is forgetting. and it doesn't even index more than 10% of the known internet, right? And also for those of you who said Firefox, Firefox is a web browser, not a search engine. There's a difference there. And then for those of you who say DuckDuckGo, a lot of people think that they do it because of the privacy, but unfortunately, there is no such thing as a privacy in the internet. Freeware has a price, and the price that you pay for it is always privacy. Related to this privacy issue, the UK government not so long ago named Facebook as the internet mafia just for all these different privacy issues they've been having recently. But the truth is, actually, there is no single best or reliable search engine. For you, for my analysts, the ones that I've trained and the ones that I continue training, I tell them that the best solution is for you to use different search engines. Different search engines will give you different search results. Also, they will rank the results in a different way, in a different order. So you can use Google. Again, Google is very user-friendly. You can use DuckDuckGo. You can use Bing. You can use Yandex. It's what really makes a difference is knowing how to combine the different searches, how to do different searches in these different search engines. Now, the training that I've done for the analysts in the private sector has focused a lot on how to conduct searches on Google, Bing, what have you, right? And a lot of the things that I teach them, it's Boolean logic, right? A lot of people that I've come across, they think that because they use quotation marks or they use the plus, then all of a sudden they're the wizards of open source collection. That's not really the case. Anything less than three words is considered child's play. Something to keep in mind is that Google can hold up to 31 keywords. Your search query should look less than three words and a little bit more like an equation, as it is highlighted down below. Instead of, you know, we're searching for the India-Pakistan conflict, right? That would be a normal search query highlighted. The search query, India plus Pakistan plus conflict, will give you a lot of noise. You also have other awesome techniques aside from Boolean logic, like successive fractioning, snowballing. These are sort of like the things that are really foundational knowledge for every single intelligence analyst in the private sector. And something that I want to highlight, that in the private sector, analysts are also collectors. So they are the ones in charge of collecting the information and analyzing it. Sometimes we get information, again, from the third-party intelligence providers or from or a personal network. But again, we're hunting for that information. It's not like in the government where you have, you have collections separate from analysis. We do everything. We're basically a one-stop shop for all in strategic, tactical assessments, and also investigations. So all the analysts need to be very familiar with these different open source intelligence collection techniques. Here, I ran the three-word query, and you have about 248 million results. You know, this is just, you see, there is a lot of noise when it comes to the results. And if I ran the query that I showed you, it gives you about 8 results, all in PDF. So it's a very good way of getting rid of all the noise and getting straight to the signal, getting straight to all the relevant information. And this is something that any successful intelligence analyst in the private sector should be able to do. He is expected to do as well. They're also expected to be familiar with social media intelligence. Right? Everybody, most people are familiar with Facebook, with Instagram, or with LinkedIn, but they also need to be familiar with other social media intelligence platforms, such as Friendster, Google+, Hi5, which is a very, very old social media platform. It's still being used in some parts of the world, MySpace, Tumblr, and Reddit. Reddit, if you know how to use it, it's a very good source for intelligence. I'm going to emphasize that. Reddit is a very good source of intelligence, but you need to know how to use it. As well, Twitter. Twitter, it's a very special tool. It provides you with real-time intelligence reporting for, let's say, travel security. And there are many tools that you can that we employ in the private sector, which are free, like Twitterfall, TweetDeck, TweetMap, Creepy, and Hoaxy. DataMiner, as I mentioned that before, that's a subscription service. But all of them really, they filter all the different tweets per keywords. Platforms like DataMiner allows private sector intelligence units to geofence a region, and you input the keywords, and then it will give you any relevant hits. So it's these tools are very important for real-time tracking of assets or executive traveling and so on, or if you have a particular interest in one area where you have a very important facility or event. So here's a picture of TweetDeck. TweetDeck is free to use. The only thing, the only requirement is that you need a Twitter account. For those of you familiar, you know you can input different keywords and it will give you all the tweets that contain that keyword, those keywords. Creepy is an open source software. When you download it, you're able to run different Twitter handles, Facebook usernames, and so on. And as long as the target person has geolocation enabled on their account, you're able to see whether tweet or whether they uploaded a picture on Instagram, for example. That's hence the name Creepy. But again, it is a very powerful tool. The only downside is that the user that you're tracking is to have geolocation enabled in their account, and a lot of people actually don't have. And I think that is an automatic thing where if you sign up for Twitter, it's not activated. So it's hit or miss, but it's a very useful tool when you're able to apply it. Again, this is DataMiner, and DataMiner, I'm not working for DataMiner, so I'm not advertising it. I'm just talking about the different tools that we use in the private sector. It is useful for real-time tracking. When I was working for a media company, we had a lot of journalists going to high-risk locations. So we had a group of journalists going to Syria. They went to Aleppo, to Raqqa, and we needed to really keep a track on what they were doing. We had other tools like nano trackers will actually get all the information of where they were going. But in terms of crowdsourcing real-time intelligence, DataMiner will be the tool to go. Again, you will just geofence and you put specific keywords like missiles, shooting, bombs, et cetera. And it will do sentimental analysis. So this is one of actually the prime tools that has been offered in the private sector. And a lot of the private sector intelligence units are implementing DataMiner. It is great for real time, and in some cases, these are actually even faster than, let's say, Control Risks or iJet and any of the other third-party intelligence providers. And even there were times where we would get tweets from DataMiner even before news outlets were starting to report it. So then we'll cautiously write the report saying that it has not been confirmed. But, you know, there's been an alleged bombing somewhere in downtown Jakarta in Indonesia, for example. And also, one of the things that I emphasized, my analyst during the training was, so they need to be familiar with foreign social media intelligence sources, like VK, WeChat, Ching, Taringa, if you're in Latin America. Not a lot of people use them. And I think these offer a lot of valuable information when you're doing research. So it is also very important for all the intelligence analysts, even if you're just a researcher, just to be familiar with foreign social media platforms. Now this is simulated social media investigation profile, right? Just to give you an example of the different, how it will look like, and the blackout parts, the redacted parts are basically just, key information pertaining to the individual, right? So this will be for, Twitter harassment, right? And the analyst will dive into open source, into public databases. They will collect last name, first name, and you can collect this from places like Spokio, Intellius, and databases similar to that. Sometimes these don't have the updated addresses, so then you will record to social media. a lot of people tend to film, believe it or not, where they live, and it's very, very funny the amount of information you're able to find on social media. It's just impressive that you're able to act, even if you're not directly friends with somebody. You can go to websites like Michael Bazell's intelligence techniques, and there is a section for social media intelligence for Facebook tools, where you can actually access, or you can see, even if you're not friends with somebody, you can see who, the pictures that they've been tagged, the pictures, their videos, their likes, their friends, and you can make connections through that. The whole purpose of the investigations in the private sector is to be able to gather as much information as you can and basically just peel the different layers of who this person is and then assess whether this person is a threat or is not a threat. This is an example of social media intelligence in action for tactical intelligence. So again, we will dive into the different Facebook groups, for example, any upcoming protests, if they're well known. For example, here at, this is from 2016, protests by teachers union in Mexico on 15 April. Teacher unions such as the CNT in Mexico are very known to engage in violent protests. They're known to engage in fights with the police and to throw rocks and other projectiles. They're known to take over the Acapulco airport. They don't really advertise on the media where they're going to hold certain protests, but on the Facebook groups, they're allowed to, or they do it. I guess in some intelligence units, a common practice is to have decoy profiles where you would just, you're building a fake profile, and then you will join these different social media Facebook groups. And this is also the way that that you will do to investigate certain single issue activists, animal rights activists, anarchist groups, et cetera, this is pretty much how you will gather social media, how this is applied to protective intelligence, to travel security. This is another example of things going on in Venezuela, all gathered from open source, of course. Strategic intelligence, the country report from Mexico in 2018. Everything is gathered open source. Now, a few case studies that I have for you from my time working in the media industry. Back in 2015, we had the Paris terrorist attacks. I remember it was Friday the 13th around 4 p.m. when we started, the Eastern time when we started hearing this chatter of different things, related shootings going on in Paris. We obtained a lot of that information actually from Dataminr, right? The media was not reporting it yet. So it was quite unusual to hear about shootings in separate parts in Paris. So we escalated to the director of intelligence, and immediately, right after we were done basically briefing the director what was going on based on the tweets, then you started having different media outlets reporting that it's probably a terrorist attack. From then on, our mission was to account for the 100-plus travelers that were located in Paris, and also the people working in Paris, so not just the travelers, but the domestic travelers. And that was quite a challenge. Imagine just having 7 people trying to account for 100 people. And not just that, but because you're working in a media company, most companies will advise their employees to leave the area of the incident. But for journalists, they need to go to that area. So it's a particular challenge because we needed to account for these people, but also to protect, to look after the journalists as they were traveling to the area of the incident. And that was a challenge. How do you do that? In my experience, a lot of the journalists, they thought that they knew better than intelligence. And in some cases, they do. I mean, they're the ones dealing with a lot of sources even before intelligence does. But it was a challenge to have them listen to us and for us to fulfill our duty of care. another case study, and this I mentioned when I was talking about regional expertise. When I was at the media company, I became the main analyst for everything to do with Brazil as we were approaching the Rio de Janeiro Olympics in 2016. And this is an example of how I tap into human sources. I met somebody at a conference back in 2015, somebody that I was working for at the Brazilian Intelligence Agency, where I established a friendship with that guy. And there was chatter that there were a few terror plots going on in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo. I asked him if he had anything that obviously was not classified. And he sent me this the security bulletin from Avianca, the Latin American airline company. Obviously, this guy was going from Uruguay from Paraguay to Brazil, and I believe he was from Taliban. I don't remember, but it was a big thing because they already had various ISIS threats going on that they were going to target the Olympics and so on. So I escalated. Once I obtained the picture of the bulletin, I escalated to the director of intelligence, and then they quickly took it up the matter in their own hands. And OSAC also disseminated this picture, we were able, in my intelligence unit, we were able to actually send out this information before it became available to the media. Actually, none of the journalists within the company knew about this, so it was. It shows the value of your personal connections. It really makes a difference in scenarios like this, where there's a lot of concern for possible terrorist attacks in such a big event like the Olympics. Now, 2017 rolled out, and we had the murder of a location manager for Netflix. At the time, there were allegations that there was cartel involvement. To this day, I don't know if he was targeted, although it seemed like he was targeted. But what did Netflix do after this person died? They actually established their own intelligence unit, and it was rather quick. You could see the job ads online for an intelligence analyst for Netflix and for a director of intelligence. Actually, the director of intelligence used to work with us at the media company where I used to work. So you can see really the need for companies like Netflix, where they go to high-risk locations to keep an eye, to keep people safe. It is spreading like wildfire, the different intelligence units. And as I mentioned before, the battle, we had journalists going everywhere to high-risk locations. So one of the examples was the Battle of Mosul in 2017, where they were within 100 meters from the theater of war. At one point, they were within 50 meters. They were embedded with special forces. So, I mean, this really shows the big challenge. I mean, we're not just dealing with travel security. We're not dealing with regular crime. We're dealing with real things that really impact, could really impact the company. How do we track journalists? I mean, we have the nano trackers. We also have data miner. We had an established route. If they were to deviate for a certain path, we knew something was wrong. They had to check in with us every hour or so. We needed to check in with them as well. It was a whole week of a 24/7 operation operating to its max ability, just because we had a group of journalists being right in front of the real war. This is another example. This could be a little bit of strategic intelligence. When the DPRK launched the mission in 2017, there was a lot of appetite from the intelligence managers to know more about the nature of the ICBM that was launched. And I had to. This was something that I had to do, and I had to author this intelligence assessment within 45 minutes, and that implied researching what was known at the time on the missile launch, but also on the past missile launches for the previous years. And I needed to put in certain chronological order, and all within a very, very narrow time frame. So this also shows the type of nature. And the reason why is because people were getting ready for the Winter Olympics operation in Pyeongchang in South Korea. It shows you the other side of the nature of information we're dealing with. Now, a lot of people may have a question, where are actually these private sector intelligence jobs? Well, they're everywhere, really, but mostly focused here in North America, within the United States. Netflix, as I mentioned before, NBC Universal, McDonald's is a big one, Hasbro, Amazon, ExxonMobil, Merck, they're everywhere. Bank of America, Uber, the world is a company. And a lot of them actually, believe it or not, they require analysts to obtain security clearances just because they also do a lot of work with the government. But this is just a very small portion of all where all the private sector intelligence jobs are. For intelligence. I want to touch also a little bit on the benefits. If you're working in government, you need to ask for a lot of permissions in order for you to travel somewhere. One of the benefits of being in the private sector, working as an intelligence analyst, is that you have the liberty to mobilize really without any counterintelligence concerns. That's quote unquote vacation time. You're able to go to overseas conferences and so on. You're able to have basically any friend that you want without reporting it back to your director when you come back. It is the same nature of the job, just dealing with all the different issues from an open source intelligence standpoint. We still deal with terrorism. We deal with crime. We deal with secrecy. Some of these positions are actually higher paid than entry-level government jobs. I mean, I'm talking about the entry levels. On average, they're $50,000 to $55,000 a year on the low end. And again, it depends on the location. And you get to experience the immediate impact. So when I've had to deal with different terrorist attacks, never in my watch I've had to break it to somebody we lost a member of the team, or we lost an employee. I was in charge of reaching out to these people, making sure they were safe. I was in charge of giving them advice, keeping shelter, liaise with this person, or this person will be calling you for the next steps on what to do, how you mobilize into a safer location. So you're able to see really the impact of your work done immediately in the company. And you're also, you're also exposed to these different major events going on around the world. For those of you who are interested in reading about the intelligence in the private sector, just recently the journal that I co-managed with Daniela Bakish was released on intelligence in the private sector. And this actually has a very good group of people that are current practitioners. We have people from the pharmaceutical industry, people from Walt Disney, people from Starbucks, you name it. We have a very good group, and it's very informational. It gives you a sense beyond what I've talked today on what is it to be a private sector intelligence analyst and the type of things that you deal with. And also for those of you in intelligence studies, it draws a parallel between what is known in intelligence in the intelligence studies literature right now and how that applies to intelligence in the private sector. Lastly, before we move to the Q&A, if anybody is interested, we have an ongoing intelligence apprenticeship in partnership with the Journal of European and American Intelligence Studies. The next round will run from September 2019 to February 2020. I am the lead open source intelligence trainer, and we'll touch on search engines, investigations, tactical intelligence, strategic intelligence, social media intelligence, basically the overview that I gave you. you'll get exposure to more intelligence literature and obviously the opportunity to publish in an international journal. It is free. It is free. You don't have to pay anything. The only thing is that you, the applicants will have to go through a rigorous interview process. That being said, we can enter now the Q&A session.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that, Efrem. That was a really informative discussion. I do see two questions right away in the chat. For those of you that haven't asked your questions yet, now would be the time to type them up. We've got two, one specific from Joanna and the other from Rachel. What are the position titles? I don't usually find these companies under the title, your typical title of intelligence analyst. And then Rachel was asking about the nature of security clearances. Do some of these positions not require an active clearance?
Right. Actually, okay, so first to Joanna, actually the title is intelligence analyst. If you look for on Indeed or LinkedIn, if you type in intelligence analyst, you will see a lot of companies, I don't know, Google, Facebook, Twitter, NBC Universal, advertising that they need an intelligence analyst for, you know, for the, I don't know, their Texas office or whatever. It depends really on the region where you're looking. So if you're somewhere in Kansas, it is really unlikely that you're gonna find a position. These positions are mainly based in the East Coast. They're starting to switch over to the West Coast. But again, I will encourage you to look into cities like New York, Washington, D.C., everywhere. Texas has a lot of positions in the oil and gas, also the pharmaceutical, and in the California area, and in Los Angeles, and in San Francisco, you have places like SpaceX, Facebook, Twitter, and in areas of North Carolina, you have all the banking institutions like Bank of America that have their own intelligence units. So I will encourage you to look there. Okay, you can just put all locations if you're in Indeed or LinkedIn, and then they should show up. As for security clearances, I will say 98% of these do not require security clearances. And this is, I guess, a lot of the attractiveness of working in the private sector is that you don't have to go through that rigorous security clearance. So you don't have to wait 8 months. It took me 2 years to get a security clearance. Right, but in the private sector, really, it's just a standard hiring process. You know, you have to go through your background check and so on. So, it's I guess it's a month worth of wait. But 98% of them do not require security clearance.
And Efrem, how would a person go about getting into this industry without prior military or intelligence experience? To your knowledge, are there any entry level opportunities, and what kind of roles lead to careers in this area?
Right, so there are a lot of entry-level opportunities in this. Again, this is an emerging field. This is quite new. As it is right now, again, I mentioned it dates back to the 70s and 80s with the oil and gas, but really the vast majority of corporations have implemented this private sector intelligence concept after 9/11, and a lot of them have failed. So They're restarting to implement this. So a lot of them are new, and they actually need a lot of entry-level analysts, junior intelligence analysts. Really, as I mentioned before, you need to have a background in intelligence studies or international relations or political science. Really, a lot of people switch. A lot of the junior analysts, they come straight from university with no previous practical experience. A lot of these things are learning on the job type of thing, okay? They don't expect you to already know all these open source intelligence collection techniques. A lot of the training is done in-house, but what I show you during this presentation was more or less how I conduct the training, the type of knowledge I expect my analysts to have. A lot of this, I can see Kimberly Smith in the next question. How do you describe work-life balance for this type of positions? It really depends. It varies. Some positions are basically shift work. So you have an 8-hour shift or a 12-hour shift, right? Some of them are salary. So that means you only work Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, right? It is really, depending on your position, I mean, if you're a junior analyst, if you're entry level, you're not really expected to be on call unless somebody calls in sick. If you're a regional intelligence analyst, maybe it's a, and there is a request that somebody's traveling to a high-risk location, or the, some of the watch officers have a question about a certain, you know, country within your region, you know, they will call you and then you will guide them through the whole process. But it's, unless you're like a director or a manager, you're not really expected to be on call 24/7, 365.
And Efren, I see a question from Al, and Al, you might need to provide some additional insight here. Al Lewis is asking, do you have standing intelligence requirements? So Al, are you going somewhere specific with that question?
Yeah, he's typing there. I can preface to say it really depends on the industry. A lot of that, from company to company, you're going to have different intelligence requirements, and there is an ongoing issue with this intelligence in the private sector units that they're really having issues actually developing and establishing properly their own intelligence units. Again, a lot of these people come from the military, you know, the managers and VP level people. They come from the IC or from law enforcement, but it's kind of difficult to apply this concept of intelligence to the private sector. And you know, if you see the scope of intelligence agencies, you know, you have a wide range of things that you cover. In the private sector, it's just the company, the people, the brand. I mean, that is it. And it's very difficult to apply this concept of intelligence, which you need to do it in a certain way. So that's why a lot of people really haven't developed this intelligence unit to the max. And the ones that have, some of them actually I have seen, they have taken 10 steps back once a lot of people leave for other companies. It's a very fluid situation, and it depends on the industry.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, Efren. One thing that I've seen at Disney is their use of threat assessment teams, and it's just another way to do their phrasing for protective intelligence of their VIPs, if you will, and also the from an HR harassment standpoint as well. So you see some within at least the threat assessment professionals group, there are organizations like the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals that are trying to create best practices for that specific area of this, but it's such a wide private sector intelligence industry.
That's right, and a lot of companies like Walt Disney, it's within the media industry, and NBC Universal within the media industry, they both do different things. So when I was with NBC Universal, we benchmarked with Walt Disney, and they were doing things differently. Now, Walt Disney, it's already been well established, okay? NBC, when I got there, I helped develop that intelligence unit, so it was not well established. So even if you have, a third media company, all the three companies will do things differently. It depends on the chief security officer, right? I don't think you can do a one-size-fits-all for all the intelligence units in the private sector within a given industry. It really depends on the president of global security, if there is one, on the chief security officer, their vision, their way. And also, a funny thing is, it depends also on their background. So unfortunately, I've been in the position where I've seen people from that were former CIA arguing with a lot of people who were former FBI. So you have a lot of, you know, tensions. You know, these people are affiliated to, I guess, quote unquote, a certain club once they transition into the private sector. So that also affects the way that this intelligence in the private sector units are being managed, organized, and how they implement the practices. It really depends also on the background of the managers and the chief security officer.
Perfect. Thank you. And Efren, I want to be respectful of your time. I do see that there's a couple more questions about the apprenticeship and internship, but I'm going to follow up with you on that since I know within the School of Security and Global Studies, our students have the ability to take an internship and gain college credit for it. So I will be following up with you over email with respect to that. But thank you so much for this wonderful discussion. I I can see that it was a very lively talk within the chat, and I'm sure it will continue to generate discussion moving forward.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. And again, send them my way if anybody has any questions.
Absolutely, Efren. I'll follow up with you later today on that. Thank you all
Sounds
for attending,
good.
Everyone.
Okay. Bye now.